Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Welcome to Food Talk here. It is, what month is this? April. It's April. It's tax. Is this tax week?
Next week, yeah.
Oh, next week. Sorry, I had to mention that. Hey, I'm a freelance 1099 guy, so it does suck. Because I always get a big pay quarterly, but then at the end of the year, it's like, seriously? Can we deduct more? You couldn't be right about this, can you? What happened? But I know Donald Trump's going to take care of all that for all of us. It's going to be a good thing. He's looking out for the little guy in the middle class. Thank you, sir. So New York's funny. I came up to New York this Tuesday, and it was like, how hot was it Tuesday? Like, what was your sense of the temperature outside, guys?
We're in the store. It's air conditioned.
It was like, I can tell you what it was, because my son took a spring break, decided he wanted to hang out with me for a week, like, just popped it on me Sunday. Had to book a hotel for the last minute. It cost me a fortune, because apparently New York was sold out this week, which, you know, you should put him in a hotel down by me that's cheap, and they're like, no, man, we only have, like, two rooms for those nights, and they're $380. I'm like, what?
A night.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's spring break. It's Easter's weekend. It's the car show. It's like a million. I think town is busy. So we're driving up the Garden State Parkway, which hugs the coast of New Jersey, and I'm looking at that little temperature gauge that tells you the external temperature, and it's a nice car. It's a Lexus. So it's accurate, and it's 88 degrees, and that's what I said. Like, how could this? Like, it hasn't been 88 degrees since last August. Like, how did this happen today? And then we got off at a rest stop before we went into the city, and, yeah, it was bloody hot. Great week, though. It's been fun. I went to Speedy Romeo's the other night. I love Speedy Romeo. You guys know the restaurant?
Yep. I haven't been yet.
Okay, Speedy's great.
I've met the folks from there.
Great guys. They started in Brooklyn with a space. I mean, one of their claims to fame is the entire kitchen's wood-fired, no gas. So everything. So great pizzas, obviously.
He was at the store this weekend. He came to pick up some...
great pizza, great grill program, just super, super food. I wish the wine list was better. You should talk to them. Just saying. And, of course, you get red wine, you have to ask for an ice bucket, because it's like, really? We ate there Tuesday night, the red wine was like 82 degrees. I'm like, yeah, this really needs like...
That's a big problem everywhere in restaurants. In the U.S.
Unless you've got...
red's too warm.
Yeah, unless you've got proper wine storage, it's a huge problem. You guys know the people at Vic's, Hillary Sterling? Vix is a great little restaurant on Great Chance. You're busy.
Oh, yeah.
You run a business.
They used to be,
something. It was the same couple that own 100 acres down in the village and a cook shop. Same husband and wife. Great, great team. Love that place. And tonight I'm going to Peasant. I love, you know, Frankie DiCarlo at Peasant. It's one of my favorite restaurants. All right, whatever. That's what I do for a living. So who am I talking to? Who are my guests today? I'm so happy. We're going to burn up an hour talking. I'm doing this again. We had three shows in a row back in February. It was Pascaline and Andy Bennett. It was Fred Dexheimer and then Victoria James and Lyle Railsback from Kermit. So three shows in a row. We just talked about wine for an hour. And the show's called Food Talk. So I'm like, I guess not. But Food Talk?
Hey,
what are you supposed to drink when you're eating, right? Seriously. So I'm really happy to have back in the studio, David, you've been here before.
Once before.
And your son, Eben, who's never been here before.
Thank you.
Who run Chambers Street. And you've heard me say this a million times. Chambers Street is one of my favorite wine stores on planet Earth. Apparently, Jancis Robinson said it's the best wine store.
The best independent merchant in the world.
In the world.
Well, it was based on customers' write-ins.
She asked the world to write.
Maybe our customers just were a little more enthusiastic. I don't know.
But it's Jancis, man. Kind of anything Jancis says, I roll with. She's good. She's got a hegemonic effect in a kind of a good way. You guys opened up. We know the story. I'll just give it a brief recap, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Opened up just before 9/11. You'd spent your jazz musician. That was your career, but you were working in stealth as a day job at Garnet for years. We got to know Louis Dresner.
14 years, yeah.
And that great palette and that great sort of style of what Dresner went after, whether he was pursuing it directly or just that's what he happened to like.
It took a while to evolve anything like that. You know, the first trips we took, we were just looking for good wine. We didn't really have a firm idea of what made it good, what made it better than other wine. But it was, I mean, Joe's very quick. And before long, we realized, okay, wild yeast, hand harvesting, organic farming. And we started, you know, looking for those things. And that progressed pretty rapidly.
And this was the 90s?
This was late 80s? Early 90s.
Early, yeah, right.
Yeah.
But it's so... funny, now I've become so biased to natural wines because it just, like, once you sort of get used to how they feel, to their structure, to their life, for want of a better term, to the malleability, how they change from corks out, decant, or first pour, how that first glass moves, how it evolves through the bottle, you suddenly realize you're having a conversation with this bottle. There's something special
same
there.
Same wines year after year, how it's a completely different
completely
experience.
Variable, right. Like, so if you love the Algarrofo, blah, 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 and you bought it the next year and it's a different wine, sorry, it was a different vintage. Yeah. The conditions were different. The spring, summer, and fall were different. It's going to reflect that, but it's crazy. And now when I drink the 97%, you know, if I'm at a restaurant that has a list that leaves you with those choices, it's just so bloody boring. Like, they're pleasant. It's not a terrible thing, but it's kind of like, really, you know? And then you're thinking, well, yeah, it's commercial yeast, and it's sulfur dioxide, and it's... possibly shitty farming practices and a lot of work done after the crush to kind of get this mummified glass of something in a bottle in front of you.
That doesn't even work well with food, necessarily, you know.
So let's talk about your latest email blast was a great one. Because your store, I said this before, your store, without exaggeration, you could walk in blindfolded, walk down an aisle, pick up a bottle here, a bottle there, get to the 12-bottle case, and not find a bad bottle of wine. You just have, it's not a huge store, but it's just incredibly well curated.
Yeah.
Because it's your store. And you had I was in there one day on my bicycle, kind of in a hurry, and one of the kids wasn't even one of your sales guy, who was like a shelf stalker dude. Like, I was asking him about something, and he was just like a wonk. He was just like, what the heck? What's your name? What do you do here? The kid just like knew everything about what I was looking for and twice as much as I did, and I'm like, all right, I'll take that bottle. Thanks. Good job. And he was like a stock guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's crazy.
The stock guys usually work their way up, and they're into it, so.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's great. So every bottle has a description. Everybody in the store knows every bottle. And you do those weekly email blasts where you'll have these pictures. It's just like so personal of the vigneron, this bearded guy with a goat behind him in the middle of a field. Or some picture of Anjou in the snow in the back of a car. And I'm like, oh, man. Because, you know, you do these tours. So these wines have faces. They have stories. There's a vigneron. There's a husband and wife. There's a family. There's a dog and a cow and a couple hectares that are being farmed by O.
That's something that's missed by the conventional wine world. It's you miss the people, and the people are just as important as the wine. I mean, you go there and you develop relationships, and you're not just drinking some product with a number on it. You know, you're drinking the life of these people and what they're into, and they're so committed to what they're doing. The natural, and I'm using that word loosely, stuff that we're buying. It's such a different world, and it's so happily non-commercial. I mean, yes, they need to make a living, but they're not really thinking about that, most of these people.
You can kind of tell that. Now, and I want to, like, I don't know how to say this nicely. You know, from time to time, I do wine tours, and I'll be on the left bank, and, you know, the Old Medoc, and you're in Bordeaux, and these ginormous estates.
Like tour bus style?
And some kid comes up to meet you, and, you know, his family owns the land, and he's got, like, a $50,000 watch, and Gucci loafers, and no socks, and his Hermes belt, and he's talking about farming, and I'm just looking at him, like, when the fuck was the last time you had a hoe in the ground? Or I mean, seriously.
Last time we went to Bordeaux was to visit Didier Michaud, is this guy who's got, what?
2 hectares.
2 hectares. I mean, this is like 4 acres. And he's got these muddy shoes on, and he slips into his wooden clogs, which I still want to get a pair of. Incredible, you know. And shows us the vineyards. And he's the one who's He's the guy working the vineyards year round.
Right, you driving through Bordeaux is pretty depressing. Yeah,
yeah, that was.
There's my kind of highlight takeaway was the kind of far right bank. Like those plate, like there were still small family farmers there. Mm-hmm. There were people that are, you know, turned around and trying to practice bio and organic and clean and, you know, planting cover crops and like doing nice work, but they were all small. They were kind of the exception, like the younger generation and the small ones, because I mean, the left bank is just what it is.
Sure.
But so your last email had to do with zero SO2 wines and sulfur dioxides. This, you know, it's, if you're a wine geek and you're into natural wines, and like I'm, and it's like, and it, there is no rule on this because I meet like young Psalms that honestly kind of don't give a shit. It's like if the wine's delicious, they don't care how it was made in a way, which sounds kind of funny because whatever. But you know, they're just not as driven by the ideals of bio and natural as maybe I am and you are and others. But let's talk about sulfur dioxide, how it's used, why it's used, and the laws behind it. Because just to explain what's going on. So want to start at the harvest? Would that be the first time we're going to see the introduction? So at reception, grapes are coming.
Well,
if you're not using
them before. Let's back up, because as I point out in the article, Pierre Auvernois, who's sort of the everyone's hero.
I start out with him.
Said the most important thing is organic farming.
Right. You need high acid. You need a high population of healthy yeasts living at the crush on the grapes at the time. And then this is a question I have for you, and we'll get this later, but why a lot of malic acid? You'll explain that to me. I couldn't figure out why that was a requirement of the three.
But getting back to the farming, because really, essentially, it all starts there. So if you don't have living soils, if you've just converted to organic, you're basically still in conventional farming. Your vines are not giving your grapes what they need to protect themselves to make that kind of a product. So Julien Guyot at Vigne du Maine, they've been organic since the 50s. Mm. Stefan Guillon has been organic since the 60s. I mean, it takes a long time to bring your soil back if you weren't lucky enough to have never gone down that road. But that's the most important thing, because there's such an amazing life going on in the soil.
Right.
And what it brings to the vine is hard to imagine. And when you read the science behind the stuff, it's phenomenal. And it's totally ignored in modern agriculture.
You know, there's a microbial diversity in that soil that's alive. There's stuff in there that has this kind of symbiotic relationship with the vines that protect it. I remember a couple of years ago, I had the pleasure of touring Alsace and was sitting up on, on that ton, that little, that Rangen was the slope, that volcanic slope overlooking with Umbrecht and the guys from Jos Meyer.
Okay.
And they were talking about that very thing, about how that reciprocity, really healthy soil supports really healthy vines. And if something does go wrong, they kind of adjust and correct it themselves.
Right.
Right? It's just like, because the vine itself is healthy and so is the ground below it.
Yeah. If their parcel isn't getting enough particular nutrients, then they actually, from so many years of experience, know which things to plant, as opposed to which product to spray.
Right. He talked about it. I like the analogy. He talked about it. It's like kind of like being in a boat at sea, where the conditions change, and you kind of have to just figure out as you're going. If the wind blows this way or that way, that you're kind of making these adjustments rather than it being like a real static sort of farming. Mm. That if you're doing bio, it is kind of this more wild. Like, let's see what happens this year, and we'll figure out what's
going on. Growers will adjust how much greenery they leave from one year to the next, depending on
canopy,
the moisture, depending on nitrogen, depending on what's going on in the soil. But but anyway, so to make wine without sulfur, with zero sulfur, it's hard. And I mean, Overmont points that out. It's a difficult thing. You have to be on top of technique. You have to have cooling systems. I mean, you don't have to. Guys like Ducru get away with it without.
They have cold cellars, so they've...
Right,
but, anyway.
But it's, you know, to use 20, 30 milligrams, which I think it's totally fine, and I'm not really having an issue with that, but to go all the way and to make wine with zero sulfur, it's a real commitment, and it's finally, I think enough people have mastered the art of doing that it's not a fringe like it used to be. I mean, in Paris 15 years ago, the wine had to really, really be in bad shape to be hip. You know, it had to be full of bread and had to have a mousy finish, and then it was good.
I remember the first few times I went to Ten Bells, going back over 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And hearing about people raving about this, and it was kind of, it's always kind of dark in there. You're kind of going to that. Once you pass the bar, it's like you can barely see. I can barely see. At night, anyway. And I remember, like, you know, the bartender, like, excitingly pouring me this stuff. And I was like, what is this shit? Like, this is, like you said, it was just like Brett City. Yeah. It was acetic acid. It was bread. It was mousy. It never blew off. It was just like, there was no pleasure for me in drinking that wine. I'm like, this is like someone's experiment that went wrong. This isn't wine making. I mean, yeah, it's grape juice, but this is not, the finished product isn't right. And then you have a who's the producer? I know in that list you had Julien Guillot, how do you pronounce him? Beaujolais Village. Yeah. I remember I had a mixed case from you one day, and you threw a couple of bottles of that in, and that's zero SO2. Yeah. And I remember opening up, the first one I opened up in my apartment, and I was going to decant it, and I poured the first glass, and it was so perfect.
Yeah.
It was so precise. And the whole way through the bottle, it was flawless. It had finesse and polish and clean fruit and definition. And I'm like, what? I mean, this is zero SO2, and that's what you came up with? No way. I mean, that's like 100. That was like, there was, that wine was crazy.
I think it started probably, when I remember people getting, so maybe the same time frame you're talking about, like when in Paris, everybody was going nuts over things that we consider kind of flawed. Like anything that was different, if people are going, oh, wow, this tastes like nothing I've ever tasted before, that was the bonus. That was like the, you know, so everybody was excited about if it was messed up, they didn't see it as a flaw. And then after, I would say maybe like 5 years later, there was like a revision of that kind of mantra. And now it's like, okay, well, mousiness that never blows away. Like you say, like flaws that never, like maybe you decant it and an hour later, these
are gone.
Yeah. The reduction.
Do that. Right.
So, okay. But if it never goes away and the finish is just nasty, then, okay, this is a flaw. I don't want to drink that wine. So people revised. And then it wasn't just that it was different, but it had to also be good and pure, like you say. I always think of, like, purity, balance is, like, what I want in a wine. I'm really happy when it has no sulfur added, but I would prefer they add a tiny bit when they bottle.
Well, that's what the guys in Alsace were saying, that because they've been practicing. Mm-hmm. You know, their Alsace is, you know, it's kind of it's on the German border, and it's changed hands a few times.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like Germany in terms of varietals. It doesn't get much rain because of the mountain range, and so it's a kind of an easier place to do it. And the influence of Steiner, I think, was early there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Umbrecht and Josmeier, those guys have been bio since the 90s.
Pierre Frick was the first, 1971.
Yeah, there's a bunch of families.
But
there
but even then, they said, I remember Umbrecht specifically, and I can pretty much quote him verbatim, that, you know, zero sulfur is an ideal. But for him to be 100% sure that if he's shipping 50, 60, 80, 100,000 cases overseas, and you cannot control the temperature, you cannot control the ambient environment of where it's going, that he sulfurs a little at bottling just so that he locks that in. And I've heard some really good California producers say, Tony Couture's been nothing for years, right? He's like that. He's like the guy. Like I can't imagine what it was like for him in Sonoma in the '70s.
When
and 80s.
He was the only, like, yeah.
What?
When he was like the only one.
The only Sonoma. One. Like, who would you talk to? Like, what's your support system? There's no one nearby to pick up a dialing phone and say, hey, I've got this problem in my vineyard. What have you done?
Right.
I don't know, man. I spray. Right. So, but he's a purist. But I've also heard people talk about using a little bit of sulfur at the end in red wines to preserve the fruit. And I kind of get it because you have. Have it where you want it. It's kind of like as perfect as it's going to get. So let's go 10 milligrams and just call it a day. And that wine we know will be stable for the rest of its life, held well. Yeah. So you can kind of argue both ways.
Yeah, it's fine. I don't think there's any, I don't see any problem with doing that. It's just when you drink a wine that's really zero, I mean, it's digest, as the French say, which is a word that doesn't translate, but it feels good. It doesn't, you can drink the whole bottle. You can taste those wines all day. You don't get a headache. I used to go to tastings like the old Salon Vin de Loire, and at the end of the day, you'd have a throbbing headache just from the sulfur. I mean, it was awful. So I zero sulfur wines really are a goal worth achieving. I mean, it's not economically possible for most people, and most producers that are larger just can't do it. You can't do it on a big scale, I don't think.
And the law is funny. So the U.S. allows 350 milligrams per liter, which is a shit ton. The EU down to less than half, 160 in reds, a little more in whites, 210.
For conventional, right? For normal.
For normal.
Yeah.
But we're talking about either zero for the wines that were all in your mailing list, or I think for the natural wines, I'm trying to think what her, for the one that she did, the raw thing, was under.
Isabel, what was
her rule for, do you remember the sulfur tolerance?
Everyone has their own, but it could be 30.
I think hers was 40. Yeah. And then a little higher for whites.
Right, and certain whites that are, if you have residual sugar, it's.
But let's talk about, so sulfur dioxide is poisonous, it's toxic, it will kill you. If you're exposed to it in large doses, you're dead.
As a gas.
If we're not talking about the kind of stuff we're drinking, we're talking about like a conventional factory farm that makes wine. Mm. They're going to bring the grapes in from the field.
Well, they start by, they're spraying it throughout the year in the vineyard.
Well, that's a different idea. I mean, that doesn't.
But that's, yeah.
In theory, that doesn't stay with the grapes by them.
This is for. Wait, so it's sulfur dioxide
in the vineyard,
that's for mildew.
Controlling mildew. Yeah.
Or, no,
but on reception, they're using it to kill anything.
On reception,
there.
They're nuking the must to sterilize.
So any yeast that are wild, they're gone, dead.
Right.
Then they're going to go with a commercial yeast.
They also have to clean it up because they've machine harvested and it's full of dirt and God knows what.
And underripe grapes, overripe grapes, little critters, all types of. So. You don't want to know what's in there.
It's getting depressing.
Hand harvest.
Now we have these pots of underripe grapes, overripe grapes, some stems, no stems, rotten stuff, a dead fly here and there, a couple of mosquitoes.
More
blow it with SO2, so now we kind of take it there. Then we're going to come in with this commercial yeast, which now we all know, like later on in life, like post-World War II, really in the 60s and 70s, I mean, you can look into a book that these manufacturers have, and you can steer the wine any way you want with that yeast. If you want a Sauvignon Blanc that's super grassy, super tropical, but we have that. If you want
the ads for the yeast are hilarious. Have you ever seen a magazine for conventional wine? They say, cassis, leather, whatever, like everything you want. They just list the flavors.
Correct.
You can basically craft.
You can create, which is kind of what, I mean, who was that? You guys must have flipped out. There was a, I can't believe the Times printed it. Remember that a couple of weeks ago?
I ignored that, yeah.
I couldn't because it came out on my Facebook feed every 5 minutes. And I'll just, what was her first name? Her first name was, who makes the vermouth in Bianca?
Oh, Bianca.
But this wasn't Bianca. The woman who wrote this.
Oh, it's the woman who wrote the book, Cork Dirk. Right, and then she wrote something.
Oh, that's her book?
I think it's. Did she write something about how.
She wrote this piece in the Times that everybody went crazy about. It was about how cheap wines are not that bad and how technology means now that cheaper wines are a lot better than they used to be. And then it was sort of this embrace of, well, look at all the things we can do post crush to. And it's kind of like to everybody that I know that loves wine and holds it near and dear is like, are you serious? Like, that's kind of, that's what we're trying to get away from. It was like in defense of 14.
So recommending yeasted.
Yeasted, polished. Manipulated, polished, fine, filtered. You need oak,
enzyme,
chips, enzyme, whatever you want. That,
well, there is another world out there of people that don't really care and don't want to spend more than $6. So, you know, it's
well, my only defense, because
really.
I had these arguments, my only defense is, yeah, it's sort of made the world of bad wine better for people who want to drink it. Because it's really, you can do so much now post-crush to make it drinkable rather than turning it into vinegar that, yeah, it makes that much more of that kind of wine available for those kind of drinkers.
But it also makes the European growers, and I'm saying European because they're the only people that can make a natural wine and sell it for €4 or €5 at the estate. I mean, you think these, and it makes you respect these people so much for, they're obviously not in it for the money if they're charging €4 or €5.
Yeah.
And the work they're putting into it is phenomenal. And it's impossible in the U.S. because land prices are too high and, you know, the whole escalation of making wine in the U.S. But family wineries in Europe can get away with it. You know, it's been passed down to them through generations. And the guy we buy from in Bourgogne, you know, I keep asking him to please raise your price. You know, it's embarrassing.
I told your son the last time I got a case of wine from you, it was mostly, I think it was all Loire, and a lot of it was Muscadet.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to you, like, if they doubled the price, I would pay it. It's just not. I mean, you had some wonderful
That's Joe Landrol. Yeah.
It was like $13, and it was delicious.
Yeah,
I'm like, this is great. It's not fair.
And
like,
that's in the three tier system too.
The cork costs money. The bottle costs money. The labor costs money. It's got to get shipped. There's profits along. I mean, honestly, those wines. Yeah. That's insane. Like that is like a $25 bottle of wine that
I still
got
don't
for $12.
Know how they do that. I feel like get it in the bottle to, you know, get it over here, and we're still paying what. But that's Muscadet. I mean, that's we're lucky for that, that the region isn't really a region full of expensive wines, you know.
And Pépierre's. I mean, thanks for introducing me to Pépierre, who I didn't really know before shopping at your store. I mean, that's like game-changing. I mean, we still think of Muscadet in that category of like peak pool plus one of, you know, not very polymorphic wines, wines that aren't very expressive, wines that aren't very floral, wines that don't have a lot of texture, wines that are just fun, you know, keep drink them really cold and oysters and drink a lot of it and who cares? And then suddenly you open up like any of Pépierre's. And it's just like, what the hell? Yeah. And, you know, a year on lees and really good farming and really careful. And some of these wines with like weight and body and texture and skeletal structure. And no, I'm like, this is
complexity.
This is,
yeah, for $14.
And I still, the most recent Clisson is still shut down. That was 15, was it?
I'm sorry, which?
The Clisson. That's Pépierre's Clisson.
Yeah, we're on 14 right now.
The 14 is the new release.
Yeah, it's still a little bit.
Oh, yeah, it's just nothing but minerals and acid right now.
Right. So what do you think? We have to wait a year?
We should wait 10 years, but no, it's great. It's great the way
I don't wait 10 years for anything.
It's great the way it is. I mean, have it with oysters. It's perfect.
So talk about your trip. Let's shut up. Forget my notes. You guys just came back.
This is a segue into our trip because you were talking about time on spent on the lees, which they're doing in Muscadet. They're doing longer surly aging, which is great.
And they can't say, and the AOC is crazy because if it's over 6 months, then they can't say surly anymore.
Something like that. Yeah. Finally, they have a new cru communal system in Muscadet so that there are legal setups for doing a year and a half, 2 years, even more on the lees and selling it at a higher level. So that's great. It's good for the growers. They'll get a little more money for the wine. So, yeah, we went on this trip, crazy trip.
Should we wrap up the sulfur thing?
We should wrap it up.
We'll
all right. I started. We segued. So the point is that sulfur is introduced there.
Dose.
You shut the fermentation down with it once you decide the fermentation's finished, and then it's introduced in bottling. So it sees
it's multiple times.
It's usually used after the mallow, and then it's used as a correction as the wine ages because the people want to keep certain amount of free sulfur in the wine as it ages. So in Burgundy, they're always adjusting the sulfur.
Yeah, they actually add because the level isn't.
Yeah,
it seems like also like any time there's going to be oxygen in the mix. Like if you're moving it from the fermentation vessel, maybe fermentation's in a big vat, and then you're going to move it into cement to develop for a year or whatever, or into barrels.
So you're pumping.
Anytime you're pumping it, they're doing sulfur. And that could be a few times. And then at bottling, they're doing sulfur. So in conventional, it could be 5 or 6 times just from when the grapes come in
from
to when it's actually sent out that they're adding sulfur.
Okay. A lot of no sulfur wines or low sulfur wines are very reductive because they haven't done that.
Describe reductive for the two people that might not know.
Well, the wine hasn't been exposed to oxygen, so. And basically they try to not expose it during the bottling. So you open the bottle and the wine is going, the wine is just like sucking in oxygen. And that chemical combination causes that aroma that we call reduction it's a musty, not particularly pleasant aroma. It goes away. It goes away in 30 minutes, an hour.
As opposed to another style, that oxidative style of winemaking that is sort of encouraged, where you see it throughout the Jura, you see it in some with Chenin Blanc and Sauvignon, and throughout the Loire, where they actually go that way, where they want an oxidative style of making, which gives you sort of nutty, sherry-ish these notes. I remember it was an embarrassing story to tell, but the very first time I had a Jura was at Bernardin, and this was when Aldo was still on the floor. It was a cheese course. We had blue cheese. Aldo comes by, and he pours this wine, and the color in the glass is kind of odd. I pick it up, and I'm... this is cherry, and I sniff it. I look at him, and I look at the bottle, and I said, "It's gone. It's not good." I mean, if you've never, I know, but I've never had it before.
Ever,
if you've never had this before, because you're drinking a glass of wine that reminds you of. I mean, it's like Madeirized. Used to be a something that happened to white wines that were exposed to leet and heightened. And I just that's what I thought we were drinking. He says, "No, that's the style of this wine." I said, "Seriously, this is what they're going after?"
Yeah,
and
now I would have done it with a Conte instead of a, it doesn't matter.
Well, and it didn't matter. And now I drink Jura like crazy. So go back to your trip. Let's talk about your trip. Pick it up. Yeah.
Okay, so.
Actually, let's do this. Hold on for 1 second. Yeah. We have to take a break anyway.
Yeah.
Big David, let's take a break. Thank you, sir. Thank you. David's working the mics for us. Anyway, I think we have a pizza out here, too. You guys hungry? Can you eat two bites of pizza in a minute?
Hell yeah.
You came to a burger. You got to do pizza. So the only reason we do the show is for the pizza. We have a spot here from the people that make the show possible. We'll be back in 2 minutes. And if we're chewing, be patient. We'll be done soon. All right. We'll be right back. folks. Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was a chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vidas living in Rome, Cola Vidas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hey, folks, welcome back. You guys are still chewing, so I'm going to wait a minute. I just ate really fast. I just inhaled a slice of pizza. I think we'd all just inhaled a slice of pizza. So let's bring it up. My guests are Evan and David Lilly. David's dad, Evan's his son. They run the greatest wine store on planet Earth, according to Jantis Robinson.
In the universe.
It's great. It really is great. I buy a lot of wine from them. It's a great store. It's just so well curated. And you have the email things, and I love it. So talk about the trip, because you guys, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks you were gone?
2.5 weeks.
February?
It's every year. It's sort of it's timed to get us to the main organic and wacky natural wine shows that occur in the south of France, but mostly in Angers, first or second week of February, depending on the year.
Yeah, you were there. Pascaline was there. Alice Firing's there. All that was just my whole the whole feed was that.
It's a sensational period in Angers. Over 4 days, you can go to 6 or 7 different. Natural, organic, biodynamic, old-time organic, all different sort of levels of trade shows. They're not really, I mean, they're much more informal than the normal trade show.
Yeah, there's one in the south that's kind of similar to a Jacob Javits Center sort of feel. You know, it's a big expo center. And the upside is the opportunity to taste with, you know, 800 different growers. Of course, we've looked at the list and we've narrowed it down to about 20. But most of them are in these beautiful spaces. Like
South is in Provence or the South in Languedoc-Roussillon?
There were two shows. There were four or five different shows. They were in Montpellier and in Marseille. Okay. Usually they're all around Montpellier. There was a fight with Vinisud, which forced them out of Montpellier. So they had to... So anyway, that
got
very
French politics.
Yeah,
it's
French politics. So anyway, we usually start in the South and work our way north. This year we started in Champagne because we wanted to visit Beaufort, and that was... we made that the logical first stop of the trip. We beat the snowstorm by advancing
the snowstorm
our flight
in New York. Yeah.
Yeah, so we got out a little early, which is great.
But the trip is typically formed around these two different weekends. There's one weekend in the south where they have a number of wine shows where you can taste the new vintages with people. Most of it is winemakers we already know and love. And their wines are pretty much, the timing is always late January, early February, because wines are basically finished. Mm. They can show the new vintage. Mm. They can give you an idea of what's to come. And then for the rest of the year, we're looking back at our notes and saying, oh, that, you know, that cuvée, that particular red from whoever was great this year. We should buy... You know, we should.
Or maybe we're looking back 2 years because, like,
yeah,
the
sometimes we're looking back.
Like,
the Philippe Tessier that we just did an email on, we tasted those 2 years ago, and now they're finally bottled. But you know, we knew exactly what we wanted to get from Zev, who's the distributor here. So yeah, anyway, in the south, there's that weekend, and it's always the following weekend in the Loire Valley that they have another string of shows. So we'll try to get to France before the shows in the south. Visit some of our friends in the south. Visit winemakers we know. and then do this like weekends, you know, 3 days in a row or four of tasting, you know, really a lot of wines a day and trying to write notes. You have to spit, otherwise you're in big trouble.
Yeah, even with spitting, it's trouble.
Even with spitting, honestly, it's big trouble.
Yeah, I find myself, you're on an empty stomach and it's a little before lunch, you're going, oh, yeah, shit, I need to eat something really fast.
You need and a get bottle some of Badois in your shoulder bag, because it's the antidote to too much wine. It's
this is a particular Badois. Badois is like Badois particular mineral water
it's,
that
it's more
apparently
basic.
You can get in New York. I haven't.
You used to be able to. You used to see it all the time.
Yeah, somebody.
So anyway, tell me about the champagne thing. This is interesting. Right, it's one of the last places I think of bio and organic and clean.
Right. My intro into the wine world in '86 was selling vast quantities of champagne at Garnet, and it seemed like bad wine with bubbles. I mean, and most of the brand names still are, unfortunately. I just didn't get it, and of course I couldn't afford to buy it anyway. But so. When it started happening, 15 years ago, smaller producers. In fact, Garnet was the first one to bring in Jacques Salos, which no one knows.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Small producers started to be imported into the U.S. who were working better in the vines, who were making wines that were less manipulated, that were more wines of terroir. So it's a relatively recent development.
And much less quantities.
Tiny quantities. All of them, yeah.
Because you think of all of those big houses. I mean, when you tour those big houses and you realize they're selling, you know, 10 million, 15 million, 20 million bottles a year, that's just crazy. Yeah. So you go in and you just see warehouses full of stainless steel tanks that will be part of the assemblage, and it's mind-boggling. I mean, in some ways it's great that they can be so consistent year in and year out, but it's just, you realize the size of this, they're just behemoths. So small growers.
So, yeah, and many years ago I was reading about, okay, who's organic in Champagne, and there aren't many, and Beaufort was always mentioned. In fact, they'd been organic since the late 60s, early 70s. And at Mille Zambio one year, I went to taste with them, and there was Jacques Beaufort was there, who was the father.
Oh, that was hilarious. They're
you know, a very roughly dressed farmer with giant hands. And I think, wow,
and we arrived right after a group of very loud Australian women who, so he was in a pretty grumpy mood,
right?
And then we stepped up, like,
you know, very different than the Moet and Chandon rep,
the LVMP group.
I mean, yeah. So
they attack you. They come out and get you. Yeah.
I knew I was going to like the wine, and indeed the wines were beautiful. I mean, they're very Venice. They are wine. They're really great wine. They don't even need the bubbles. The farming is great. There is no sulfur added in many vintages, not all, but in many vintages there is zero sulfur. Both fermentations, both the alcoholic, the first and the second in bottle, are done with wild yeasts. So, and they do that by preserving wine and adding that, you know, when they do the secondary. So, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary, the amount of trouble they put in. And they also basically bottle on demand. So if you're ordering a 1996, they disgorge it for your order. So it's been Sur Lee for 20-some years. So that's...
Whoa!
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Whoa!
So
one of my first early loves was Bollinger RD for that reason. When I sort of didn't know much, I just was attracted to that because of the amount of time on Lee's. I was wow, this is totally different. This is like champagne
how
that's got
years
stuffed. Right, like that's what my... So, wow, that's crazy.
No, it is crazy. I mean, they...
Is this the wine dinner scene coming up? You're going to be pouring his wines?
Yes, that's at Racine on May 2nd, I think. We're going to do a dinner with vintages from 2003 back to 1979.
So you can find out at your website how to buy tickets for that dinner, because
that
sounds
that's
epic.
That's going to be on the Racine website this weekend, yeah.
And because Racine's tiny, 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 so if you're into Champagne, it's taking place in New York.
We're just going to do 10 seats. It's got to be a small group, because we only have one bottle of most of these things.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, that's the point being that this is extraordinarily different than other Champagnes. But we had never been to visit them. Some people in the store had, but I'd never been, actually, so... we spent a day with them, and you know, he disgorged a couple of bottles for us in his. They do it by hand.
They disgorge, and then they suck the, you know, to make sure the bottle's good. They basically suck the top, like every single bottle. Someone's got to taste test it. I just thought that might be a nice job.
But
yeah, and I miss it. LVMH owns like all the other huge brands. I was laughing about it. It's like, so champagne's so funny. And I was sitting next to somebody the other night, and I'm not going to say who it was, But I want to ask you, because I don't drink Cristal. It's just, I don't drink it. Not, it's out of my price. If I'm going to do it for champagne, I'm going to go somewhere else. But he was raving about Cristal, how great mm-hmm. Cristal is. What do you think about Cristal as a cuvée?
I don't really think about it at all.
all right.
But I think most of the big houses are capable of putting out
well, the
very
cuvée.
Good,
the
very good
cuvée. Yeah, they are. So, I mean, $150, $200 a bottle with limited production. Yeah. It's remarkably consistent. Some of them do just a single year's vintage. That's the exception. Most of them blend the best of the best years from the Premier Cru parcels.
Right, and it might be the parcels that they started with whenever these companies were just family estates. You know, it's not the bought fruit, but... So from Champagne.
So yeah, this was a crazy trip because we had to cover. We had to go all the way south and then all the way back north again.
We drove almost 3,000 miles.
Oof.
Yeah, more. It was like 35, something like.
That's a lot. I do road trips when we film, and that's a lot in 2 weeks.
A lot. It was Champagne. Then we were in Burgundy.
In Burgundy, we tested with Jane and Sylvain. So here's a totally unknown 4-hectare organic Burgundy estate that makes terrific wine. Exactly the kind of people that we like to work with.
Yeah, it's literally unknown. Jane Sylvain. That's the name of the estate.
They don't go anywhere. They don't go to any trade shows. They don't, you know, they just stay home, work in the vines.
We're in Burgundy. Where?
They're in Gevrey. They're right in the town. They have this fabulous little hidden cellar you have to, you know,
they
crawl
have like three
into,
different
basically.
Ones. They don't even have one cellar. They have one. They have to lift up this metal plate, and then you know, watch your head. And you step down, and it's like, I don't even know.
That's fairly common in Burgundy, but this it's
and not a whole lot of barrels you're looking at either.
Oh, no. There's their room of barrels, so maybe there's 15 or something.
Right.
But they have a parcel of Gevrey Fontenisse, which is right next to Rouchot, and not Fontenisse kind of falls away. I mean, they're actually right at the level of Rouchot, next to Rouchot, just separated by a dirt road, and it's fabulous wine. So, I mean... Things like that happen. You find people like this that, oh, by the way, we have this parcel. It's Rouchot, and we sell it for 15 euros or whatever it is. So it's don't quote me on that. But at any rate, so that was our next visit. So we're in Burgundy, and we visited Lafouge, who is a great old small estate in, based in Auxey-sur-Rhône that makes fabulous wines.
Well, how long have you known Jean-Marie for...
Yeah, it's through an agent named Jean-Marie Deschamps, who's the hardest working woman in Burgundy.
She's definitely the hardest working sole person in Burgundy. I've learned more about Burgundy just driving in the car with her.
Listen.
And we'll be passing, you know, she's like, oh, that's the Premier Cru, whatever vineyard, and oh, there's Bone, you know, and I'm looking and I'm seeing the slopes and, you know.
So from there we had to hop over to the Jura because we've been working for a number of years with a guy named Jean-Charles Maire, who unfortunately passed away suddenly of a heart attack a year and a half ago, and... So we wanted to meet with his daughters, who retained the property, and taste with the new winemaker who used to work with him. So it was, you know, emotionally difficult visit because he was a great guy, and we'd met him twice, and you get immediately very friendly with a guy like that who was so proud of his farming. And
yeah, he was great.
Yeah, really fantastic guy.
Reds and whites?
Yeah, 4-hectare in Salins-les-Bains, which is the north of the Jura, and most of his terroir is on Kimmeridgian limestone, which is very unusual in the Jura. Only a small parcel of what he has is on the more normal Marne-type soil. The wines are brilliant, and there's so little wine available in the Jura.
It's like 1.5%, 2% of the total production of France.
Yeah,
it's tiny. It's so funny how it's become popular. So I was having this discussion with some retailer the other day about how the Riesling still has this sort of stigma of it being people, even the young public, thinking that it's a sweeter wine or that it's a sweeter style. And I mean, with all that Paul Greco did and all the stuff that's been out there, you'd think by now people would get it, you know, not just Riesling from the various German producing regions, but from Austria and from Alsace. But they were saying, like, you know, Jura outsells Riesling like crazy. I'm saying, so funny.
Oh, yeah.
But, right? You find this, too. And you guys
it depends on where you're walking into.
But that's really funny.
It's hard for Jura to outsell anything because
there's nothing there. And I've fallen in love with the wines. Yeah. I mean, and you have a great selection of them. I mean, they can be super clean. You can have Chardonnay and Sauvignon that are just pure, and or you can go oxidative and it's like funky and a whole different food pairing. And then the weight of Trousseau and Ploussac. I love those reds.
I think they're still new for a lot of people.
Oh.
You know, people are just getting into wine. They haven't tried. People that have already, it's still a new thing. Sure. I thought it would be like a fad, but it's... I'm happy it's
and
not.
And the perfect. Grape Sauvignon, whether it's Houillet or whether it's Sauvignon, it's just fantastic. It's and it's such a grape. Mineral expression. It's almost like Merlot
de Bourgogne. Sauvignon, not Sauvignon Blanc.
Right, right. That other spelling.
S-A-V-A-G-N-I-N. This
correct.
Is a different grape altogether.
White grape varietal from the Jura.
So then we had to get back immediately to Burgundy to go to Vigne du Maine, which is a very important estate for us. So this is, we were talking about people who have been organic for a long time. So Vigne du Maine was purchased in the 1950s by Julien Guyot's grandfather, who refused to use chemicals and did not even use chemicals, did not use sulfur in making the wine at all. He didn't add sulfur to the wine. They now add a little bit to the white wines, but they do not add sulfur to the reds at all. And Julien says, you know, I don't need to with that long of a period of great farming, and they have great terroir. They have great limestone clay terroir.
Well, people think, I mean, there's this conception that there is no bio work being done in Burgundy. That it's because it's so difficult. We know it's a tough place to grow grapes. We know that from vintage to vintage, it can drop 50. But then you think like DRC's been doing this for years.
Yeah, I think it's been increasing. If you look at the percentage of actual vineyards in organic, I mean, just to take organic for an example, not even biodynamic. But 10 years ago compared to now, it is a huge increase in the percentage, the acreage, if you will, in Burgundy. A lot of other regions, it's...
Well, they can certainly afford it because, I mean, they should. I mean, no, but in these small estates, it's the winemaker that's out there all year doing the handwork in the vineyard. I mean, organic farming is definitely more manual labor in the vines. And if you're DRC, you just pay an army of guys to go do it. It's fine. But it's not so easy for the small people to do that.
Yeah, so, and with land costs at an acre costing $500,000 now, it's like Champagne. The prices of land in Burgundy and Champagne are almost the equivalent. Yeah. You want to buy a hectare, it's $1 million if it's a decent parcel.
But yeah, it's great. This guy, Julien, the winemaker. I mean, his father's always there too, just kind of hanging out. When we got there, his father was inspecting these strange, like, nautical navigational tools that some people had brought in a box.
Antique tools, a whole assortment of different antique tools. No one knew what they were.
Or what they were even for.
Julien used to be navigating by moonlight or something.
Julien used to be a acrobat, actor, and so he's just this nimble, he's full of energy, and we had this long, we tasted everything from everything, every vat, every barrel, and we're talking about politics and New York and France and America, and, you know, just, and jazz music, and just you name it.
Shame I missed all that.
Yeah, it's really a great family.
So then we jumped to the Northern Rhone to visit some organic people we work with.
No, you missed Ducru. I missed Ducru.
No, I didn't. Ducru was after.
No. I have...
He's got his photo.
You're right, my photos of all the dogs.
So Christian Ducru.
All the wine dogs.
Christian Ducru is, to me, a guy that does perhaps the best farming of any vineyard I've ever seen. He's so totally involved in the life of his soil, what's going on in the soil.
And he's always in the vines.
And he's completely involved with, you know, controlling the amount of moisture. And, you know, he doesn't want that much sugar in his grapes. He wants the wine to be at 10 degrees. That's his goal, is to make the wine at 9 or 10 degrees.
And he's in Northern Rhone?
He's Beaujolais. I mean, he doesn't really, I don't think he particularly read Jules Chauvet, but he's making wine in the same style as Jules Chauvet. And the farming is amazing. I mean, he's ripped out every fifth row and planted trees. He's got hedges everywhere. If you're there in growing season, the plants around the vines are higher than the vines. Oh, that's good, because then the vines don't get too much sun and the grapes don't get too ripe. They get mature. You can have mature grapes that have all the flavor you might possibly want, but have it at 10 degrees.
Right, so it's
you don't
less
need
powerful.
To be at 14 degrees.
Right.
Chauvet, in one famous line, said, you know, a Beaujolais at 14 degrees is a sin. And that's where many of them are these days. I mean, in 2015, it's not the grower's fault, but still. In 2015, Ducru was at 12.5 degrees, even in a vintage that was that hot and that sunny all year.
But this is a region that's really turned itself around since the 80s, too.
Yeah, it's still hard, though. It's very hard because prices are so low. A lot of growers have dropped out or sold. People in Burgundy are buying land in Beaujolais, which I'm not sure is a great idea.
Yeah, they're coming down. Because the Mecon,
there goes the neighborhood.
The Mecon, the southern tip of Burgundy, sits right next to the northern end of Beaujolais.
So
neighbors.
Far, most of the wines made by Burgundy producers in the Beaujolais, I haven't been too crazy about. They're just too
and
polished.
Then guys like Jean-Paul Brun are actually doing, instead of Carbonic, they're actually doing a Burgundian Crush.
There's not much of that.
He's an outlier.
Yeah, okay. For sure. There aren't many.
What's that one that you sell? It has a crazy name because the guy doesn't want to be part of the AOC. It's called Excepcion.
No, that's your crew.
That's oh, I love his wine. I love his wines. Yeah, you don't have a lot of it. You have like
we have the 2015 Expectasia. We'll get the 16 in a month or two.
Delicious wine.
The 16s are beautiful. I mean, they're really light, but they're just perfumed and gorgeous. And this is a no sulfur wine that. Okay, it's going to change. It's going to be different maybe every time you open it, but it does age. You cannot keep the bottle open for a number of days. You just can't do that.
It's a 15.
It's alive. There's too many bacteria in there that will start working and having a party in your wine. But
So from Ducru, then we went to Northern Rhone.
Yeah.
And visited
Demendez M4.
Yeah, this is an estate that we've been working with for a while, but never actually met them. And what a visit. The guy was, he was just jumping around, like running all over, showing us how healthy his vines were. Because this is, they've been organic for a long time, but started doing biodynamic work in the vineyards maybe, I don't know, somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago. And he was just like so excited. He was like a little kid. Like immediate results that he'd seen after just a few years or even just 2 years of doing it, that he had just been blown away with how his vineyards had responded. And we just spent a day just like driving around.
It's nice meeting people like this. We work with a lot of people like this who are not part of the natural wine world. They don't go to the trade shows.
Yeah, these folks
are basically totally unknown. And we come across them through books or reading or suggestions or whatever. People that have been organic for a long time who are basically just stay at home, but they're so happy and involved in what they're doing in their farming, and you see this is just an average guy. He's not someone that's been influenced by Marcel Lapierre,
right,
or that's hung out with
the luminaries,
whatever. Yes. But a guy that's working his ass off to create healthy soils and create better wine, and it's great to work with people like that. So that was in Chavanay in the north, Northern Rhone. Then we went down to, we wound up in Gigondas, which is a fabulous estate. Danny and Carol Chaston, who have been, the estate has always been organic. They never used chemicals, so you can go back to the 1900 or wherever. They've never used any chemicals in the vineyard.
Before they even had chemicals.
This is Southern Rhone, old school vinification with whole clusters. So They don't de-stem. The stems are ripe. They're not all clones.
Grenache driven.
It's Grenache driven.
Yeah.
They age in old foudres or in concrete. I mean, which is when I first started traveling in Rhone.
So you've got that fruit.
In the late 80s, I mean, no one had barrique or new oak. Everyone was using old foudres, and for me,
it's perfect.
I mean,
it's perfect.
It makes sense.
The expression of the fruit is there. You're preserving it. You're not
so much character.
I know. I was. That's what. I keep going.
So we're tasting. We tasted many vintages there, going back quite a ways. But 2015 is a terrific vintage in the Rhone Valley. I mean, people had both north and south. People had rain during harvest, depending on when they picked. Apparently, Thierry Allemand picked before any of the periods of rain, even at 13 degrees. Gonon, who we visited, who is one of the most respected growers in the Northern Rhone now, said, well, he didn't think the grapes were quite mature enough, so he waited, and there was some rain, but he said the grapes were so healthy that the rains didn't really bother them at all. All in all, 2015 in the Rhone Valley is terrific. I mean, in Beaujolais, the wines were there was just too much alcohol. I think in Burgundy, a lot of people are complaining that the wines are a little hot or a little just too much fruit. But that's going to vary from place to place. But it's a vintage that reviewers have been very enthusiastic about, sort of across the board. And it's not like that. Every region, it's a little different. But in 2015 in the Loire Valley, they got rain during the Cabernet Franc harvest. So Chinon that would have been out of this world is merely great. Yeah. But anyway, in the Rhone Valley in 2015, a lot of terrific wines, and that have some freshness on top of this really dense fruit and dense ripeness and good ageability. So from Gigondas, we went down to Provence. Totally mixed up. We went to visit our biodynamic friends in Provence.
And then
we make sensational wines. This is another example of people that do not concern themselves with the broader sort of commercial wine world. They're not part of the hipster natural wine movement, but they've been biodynamic for a long time. They use some sulfur, but not very much. They don't really go there in terms of, they don't really have a feeling about trying to make a no sulfur wine. But they make rosés that are absolutely sensational. You know, wild yeast.
It's called Domaine Les
Great Fou. Farming.
I think you've had the wines before.
I don't remember.
I see
them.
Peter Weigand is actually selling one of their cuvées now. So
okay.
Yeah. But anyway, fabulous visit. They have
what
problems.
What vintage do you have in the store now?
We just finished the 16. Yeah, the 16s will be here in a month. About
yeah, okay. It's not soon enough. Yeah. People are already banging on the door for rosé.
Well, it was 80 degrees on Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all going to get winter past this. And we're all drinking more.
So then we had to go all the way over to Montpellier. Because,
back the other side.
And then after Montpellier, we came back to Marseille.
Then we're tasting wine. Then we're tasting. And I've stopped complaining because I used to come back from these trips and someone would say, oh, how was the trip or whatever? And say, oh, man, it's really work. You know, you're tasting 100 wines in a day and the acid's just tearing away at your enamel. Your teeth hurt. Your body hurts. And all
but
people
at least
say
we're not
is,
getting
oh,
poisoned with sulfur.
You're tasting 100 wines a day, and you're complaining. So I don't complain anymore. But yeah, no. I've...
At least we're not getting poisoned with sulfur like it used to be. So that's great.
Yeah, you saved me from that.
So then...
I'm spoiled. I've never even...
So Minas&Bio is the biggest organic trade show anywhere. It's a huge show. I think it was 900 exhibits.
Where is it?
Yeah, last year it was like 650.
It was in Marseille this year, which was completely crazy because it's a difficult city anyway, and there was a soccer match between Marseille and Lyon.
It's a port town.
The whole town was going crazy.
Was it Marseille-Lyon?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So no one's working. Everyone's watching the TV. The bars are filled.
We're walking out of this tasting event.
You hear roars coming out from every bar.
Well, the game hadn't started. This was just pregame. This is just people just getting wasted outside of the...
This is a great show. I mean, it's not all the hipster. Pardon me, Zev, but actually Zev does go to this. I think, but all the hipster importers don't go to it necessarily.
Zev, to this. Zev and hipster in the same sentence. Sorry, Zev. Sorry. And the unicorn wine movement.
There's a lot of bad wine there. I mean, you can make bad organic wine. It's very easy. Just as easy as. But there are a lot of small producers that pay up and go to this, and that's the only show they go to because that's they can only afford to do one.
Right.
And so we can visit, I don't know, 20 different producers that we already work with. Plus, you know, there's always people there. And Eben did a fantastic job this year. And before these trips, you need to do a ton of research. You have to have your shit together about who you're going to taste with where, what makes most sense. But Eben also, and I used to do this going back 30 years, you know, just combing the French press, who is out there that we should visit, you know, and why, and what are they doing? And Eben did a fabulous bunch of research this year. So we, at many of these shows, we found new people that are completely unknown.
All right, I'm going to stop you there.
Yeah,
we only have 2 minutes. No, it's not getting boring,
no.
But I want to throw this at you because this is totally... totally a segue. So speaking
Part
of weird
one.
People that nobody's ever heard of and strange producers, who the hell is Evan Lewandowski? This guy in Utah, and this is a connection to Zeus. This is a totally great time. So you have this blurb that goes out, and I'm reading about this kid that's making wine in Utah. I'm like, I didn't know they had grapes growing in Utah.
Well, no, he's working.
His source is in California.
Right. He's working on the Utah thing.
But he works with Zev in a bar in Utah? I mean, I didn't even know Zev was from Utah.
Yeah, Zev was out there for a while.
So he worked in a bar. So he got the wine bug working with Zev, and obviously some kind of organic unicorn wine bar in Utah, which is, I mean, don't think of wine as the Mormons much in the same sentence, but he grows wine in California, starts the vitification, then he moves it in like U-Haul vans and whatever, in like tubs, to Utah where he ages it.
And he's found, I mean, none of his wines are, none of the grapes are grapes that you
It's all
he's
field
got
blend.
Skin Contact Cortese, he's got Grenache Gris, like where he's finding these vineyards even.
Sell his wines at the store.
We usually have one or two. We have the Grenache Gris, and we have a red from his, the Boas.
What a crazy story.
Carignan. I think it's Carignan Pure. A dark and savory. Yeah, he's cool. We met him
He came by last year to the store.
What a funny story. I just love to read about this kid. There's a picture of him. I mean, like, I could just see like in a U-Haul truck with a big fiberglass barrel. Driving the grapes from California, Utah. I'm like, dude, that's such a story.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, it was a pleasure. Like, it's funny. People come in here thinking an hour is going to take a long time. Like,
we didn't even get back to the Loire Valley.
No, we didn't get anywhere. We didn't get to the Loire Valley. I know.
You missed the man Pierre Gonon in
We think of that Augury Fogue and And then you have the crazy guy growing that Altesse that blends the guy. What's that guy's name? I got some of his wines from you. He does a really weird blend.
Oh, Maillet. Jacques Maillet.
No. I think. Now, no? Who's this
he retired. He just retired.
Who's his name? Balmes Dauphinoise. Who's this guy? Gonin. Nicolas.
Oh, Nicolas Gonin, yeah.
Great. IGP. See, I never heard of this. Saint-Chef. Yeah, I've never heard of this
Isère,
region.
Yeah. We've got a name for you to look out for, which is Thomas Fino from the Isère, which is over there
it's
near
the same region. Yeah.
And Pascaline knew this guy, because Pascaline knows everything. Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah.
Great work. David Lilly, Evan Lilly, the name of the store is... Chamber Street. Chamber Street, Tribeca. They ship, they do everything. They've got websites. Just don't buy the stuff that I want, okay? Just get out of my way with the mailing list. Wait 2 hours. Great guys, great store. Thanks for doing
Mike. Thanks for having us, Mike.
New York City. No, pleasure. And we didn't talk about Dirty Bird, did we?
No, no, but that's fine.
Jesus, next time.
That's all right.
Next cycle. Thank you.
Yeah.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.